decided during the day that in the evening class we'll be discussing Sharanagati. We made some photocopies of some songs that we'll sing together in the course of this presentation. You're going to have to share. Probably we don't have enough even for one for every second person, so you have to look on with two or maybe three people. So as they circulate, in the whole of Sharanagati, the songs by Bhaktivinoda Thakur, there's a total of 50 songs. And what he's done in the form of the songs is that he's expressed the same thing that Ramanujacharya and Madhvacharya and Jamunacharya and Lord Chaitanya and Sanatana Goswami and Jiva Goswami and Rupa Goswami and others that have elaborated on this topic. He's made it very, very easily accessible just by singing songs. Even people that can't read, just by hearing the songs, they can learn the songs and learn the philosophy just by singing songs. And also, within the songs, there's deep moods of humility, moods of surrender, moods of expression of feeling protection and safety, and so forth. So that effect is also there. This subject can be taught in a very expanded way, in a detailed way, or in a capsule way, or somewhere in between. So we'll have something like 6 days to discuss these topics. 7 days. It can be taught. One of our sannyasis knew that I had Giridhari Swami. He's mainly based in Hong Kong and the Philippines and that part of the world. American sannyasi. And he taught this course in Vrindavan for one full month. And in teaching the course for one full month, I'm sure they spent some time each class just singing the songs, relishing the meanings of the songs. And also the meter of the songs that Bhaktivinoda Thakur used was variegated. In other words, the meter also helped to establish a mood. Some were short, some were more melodious. And so it's a very wonderful topic. And as I was expressing this morning, it's very important to contemplate, even before we begin, how can I apply this? Because we need to surrender to Krishna. That's his instruction. All other dharmas, they're secondary. This is primary. And we can even think specifically in terms of how we approach chanting the holy name of the Lord. Because that's our expression of approaching the Lord in a mood of surrender through His holy name. We approach Him in the form of His holy name, and the mood of that approach should be one of surrender, submission, and service. So I'm requesting and pleading with you, please consider these subject matters in a very personal and practical way, how to increase the mood of surrender to Krishna. So I mentioned this morning that there are some specific impetuses for surrender, for adopting even the effort to try to surrender to Krishna. There's many, but I'll just indicate three categories. One I mentioned this morning was a sense of danger. When one's life is threatened or safety is threatened, one can turn to Krishna in a mood of great surrender. There are examples. The microphone this morning was first class. A big one?
Yes, sir.
It's not possible to do it now, perhaps, but that's the best microphone they make in America. Very expensive. So maybe in the future we can have that microphone. Can you hear me better now? Oh. So, have any of you had any accident, maybe a car accident or a bike accident, or some life-threatening experience? What happened when that took place? Where did your mind go? Chanting. Same? Oh, before you became a devotee. Since you've been a devotee. I've had devotees tell me many stories of being in a car or being in a van, going on Sankirtan. One story was that there was a group of five devotees. They were distributing books, and they had finished one function late at night, and they were going to where they were going to take rest, and the driver fell asleep at the wheel, and he went off the side of the road. It just so happened it was a very steep embankment, about 300 feet down, with jagged rocks, and the vehicle was tumbling over and over and over, crashing and tumbling down towards the rocks, and everybody in the vehicle was at the top of their lungs chanting, "Krishna, Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna, Hare Hare Krishna, Krishna, Krishna." They landed upside down and nobody was hurt. The vehicle was finished. Nobody was hurt. Or very recently, one disciple was visiting another devotee, and they had rented a car from the airport to go to their place, and it was a stormy day and traffic was very slow and the road was very slippery, and suddenly something appeared in the front of the road and they swerved to go around. The car went out of control and it flipped over three times up, and they landed up upside down. They had a seatbelt on. This is a 60-year-old Mataji. upside down hanging, just chanting, thinking, if Krishna wants to take me, what can I do? Just chant Krishna's name. They were actually not panic-stricken and fearful. They hadn't done anything bad or anything wrong, just the car went out of control. And there the car came to a stop, and there they were, upside down, held in by the seatbelt. The car was finished, and they had not a scratch. But when there's, so, and many other examples, when there's danger, thought comes of God. I'll mention this one. In New York, after September 11th, so many people turned to God. I wasn't in New York when that event happened. I was in Chicago. But I was hearing the day-by-day description that many people just didn't go out of their homes. New York is a very pedestrian city. Millions and millions, just amazing, a sea of people walking around, and there was nobody around. Stores were shut down, nobody was walking, it was quiet for days. But when people did go out, they went out and set up a little altar. All different religions, they have some kind of thing for where they worship, so they, it became fashionable. They got candles and incense and some, maybe even not even some pictures, maybe some pictures, and they would pray, they would sing, and they turned to God. Actually, they turned to three things: God, the American flag, and gas masks. Any store that had American flags sold out quickly. And any store that had gas masks, because they were afraid the next thing was going to happen was this biological warfare. So gas masks sold. But they weren't just surrendering to God. They were making sure. They had their gas mask and their American flag. But they turned to God. But their conception of who is God was very shallow. One devotee was describing to me that as he was traveling, just walking, about a week later, walking on the street chanting japa, there were two middle-aged American ladies walking behind him, and he heard their conversation, and they were saying, one of them distinctly said, "I think now is the time I have to try to understand the purpose of life." Danger is a big impetus for surrender. A second one is frustration. Not necessarily that there's a life-threatening situation, but I'm trying and trying and trying and trying for happiness, and it's not coming. I'm feeling very frustrated with life. God, please help me. So, we all know examples of frustration. And a third is intelligence. In Nectar of Instruction, Prabhupada describes different grades of intelligence. Anyone know these different grades of intelligence described in Nectar of Instruction? What's the first class intelligence?
first class intelligence is to learn by hearing.
The first class intelligence is to learn by hearing. Shabda, Shruti, one hears the message of the Vedas and understands. That's first class intelligence. And second class intelligence, one hears, doesn't understand, and sees from practical experience in life, oh, that's how it works. And then one learns. Second class intelligent. Third class, one hears, doesn't understand, sees, doesn't understand, experiences themselves, they suffer, then they understand. Fourth class intelligent, hears about it, sees it, experiences it, and still doesn't understand the perils of material existence. A very nice example, two nice examples of first class intelligent. One is Prahlad Maharaj. He heard from Narada Muni when he was still within the womb of his mother. He had not yet experienced anything outside the womb of his mother. And he became a realized, perfected soul just from that hearing. And so when he was born, he didn't hear anything good from his teachers or from his parents because his father was Hiranyakashipu. So no spiritual understanding from his father. But yet he was fixed in shelter at the lotus feet of the Lord. By what process? There are nine processes of bhakti. What is the process by which Prahlad is known to have perfected his life? One, two.
Which process?
Smaranam. He constantly remembered the personality of Godhead. Very good. Constant remembrance of the personality of Godhead, Prahlad Maharaj. He perfected his life. So much so that whatever danger come, his mind was not disturbed. Whenever praise came, his mind was not disturbed. He was just fixed in remembrance of the personality of Godhead. Another is Maharaj Ambarish. He also learned, as Prahlad did, just by hearing. He had first class intelligence. It's described about Maharaj Ambarish that he had opulence that was inconceivable. Actually, his father, what's his father's name? His father was cheated out of the kingdom by his brothers. But because his father had such wonderful qualities, his father had gone off as a young boy to study in the Gurukula. At that time, the Gurukula meant going to the forest where the guru lived in his ashram with his wife, and he accepted some students. And he stayed a very, very long time, so long, and he was the elder brother. Nabhaga, that's his name. Father's name was Nabhaga, and he was Nabhaga. So Nabhaga went to the forest And the other younger brothers, they all grew up. And when they were of age that they had to have some maintenance, they approached their father. An arrangement was made where the kingdom of the father was divided amongst the sons. Because they were thinking, Na Bhaga, their elder brother, he probably just wanted to stay in the forest with his guru and remain as a brahmachari, because that's, there are two paths that one can follow through the course of spiritual education and training. One is, after that spiritual education and training, to take up the responsibilities of household life. And another option is to remain brahmachari. So since he didn't come back, they speculated, maybe he's just very happy living in the forest with his guru, and we have to get on with our life. So they divided up the kingdom. And then Na Bhaga came back from the ashram of the guru. And one of Na Bhaga's qualities was that he was very simple hearted, but not in a bad way, in a good way. He wasn't a complicated, materially calculating person. So he approached his brothers and said, what's the arrangement for me? I also have to have a place to live. And the brothers said, well, we've already divided up the kingdom, it's too late. So we say that our father is your property. And so Na Bhaga said, very well. So he went to his father and relayed to his father what his brothers had said, and his father said, don't trust a cheater. They're just trying to cheat you. Your father can't be your property. Whoever heard of such a thing? But I am your father, and it's my responsibility to see that you have some means to maintain yourself. So I have a practical suggestion. Right now there's a big yajna going on. The descendants of Angira Muni, they're performing this yajna. And I just happen to know that on the sixth day of their yajna, they're not going to know how to perform they're not going to know a couple of hymns and mantras they're supposed to be reciting. So I'll teach you those mantras. And when it comes time they don't know, you can volunteer. I'll do this for you if you like. And they'll be so happy that they'll give you the charity of all the remnants of the sacrifice, and so you'll have everything you need to maintain yourself. Because it's a very, very opulent yajna they're doing. So Na Bhaga said, very well, as you say. So he went, and sure enough, that's what happened. And so they were very happy, and they gave him all the what was left over from the yajna. And it was huge piles of gold and precious jewels and ornaments and fine cloth and so many things. So Na Bhaga was busy gathering up all these things. And one strange person, very dark in complexion, came down the path, saw what Na Bhaga was doing, and said, what are you doing? Na Bhaga said, well, I'm gathering up what was left over from the yajna. And the person said, well, you can't do that, it belongs to me. And Na Bhaga said, no, it belongs to me. The sages that were performing this yajna, they gave it to me. I asked for it in charity, and they gave it in charity. And the person said, well, they may have given it to you, but they had no right to give it to you because it belongs to me. So I have a suggestion. We'll solve this problem. We'll go ask your father. And whatever he says, we'll both accept. And Nabhaga said, very well. And he explained everything to their father. The father listened very carefully and said, actually, he's right. The sages giving these things to you had no right to give it to you because it actually belongs to Lord Shiva. Who is this other person? So everything should be that you've collected, you should turn it over to Lord Shiva. And Nabhaga said, very well. Everything I'll give to Lord Shiva. So Lord Shiva said, I'm very, very pleased with the qualities of both of you, the father and the son. I'm so much pleased that I'll tell you what, you keep everything. And not only you keep everything, but I'll teach you transcendental knowledge. I'll train you to become a pure devotee of the Lord. I'll give you my full mercy. Because material commodities, that's not the full mercy of a great Vaishnav. But training one in spiritual knowledge and awakening pure devotion in the heart, that's the greatest gift. So I'll give that to you. And Nabhaga said, very well. He said, because you have pleased me with these two qualities, you are very simple in heart, and you're very truthful. So because of those two qualities, simplicity and truthfulness, Lord Shiva was pleased. And Nabhaga became a great devotee and very, very wealthy. But his son, Maharaj Ambarish, he inherited the wealth of his father, but he had no kingdom. But because his son, Maharaj Ambarish, was such a qualified devotee, he heard from his father, who had heard from Lord Shiva, he became a pure devotee. Just by hearing. And amongst all of his brothers, the sons of all of his brothers, it was very clear that Maharaj Ambarish was the most exalted. And so he was made emperor of the world. He didn't inherit the title, he just rose like a self-effulgent personality. As the most qualified person to be the emperor. So now he was ruling the world. He had inconceivable wealth, but he was detached from it all. Why? Because he understood from hearing something that's quite obvious. This is all temporary. It's as temporary as whatever possessions you might have in a dream. Very quickly, a dream is over. Very quickly, a dream is over. And so, although there is all this wealth, I'm not attached to it. Then it's further described in the Bhagavatam that he understood not only a devotee should be not attached, but a non-devotee who has wealth becomes gradually more and more degraded by that wealth. They fall deeper into darkness of ignorance because of that wealth. They become attached. And the ways that they use that wealth drag them down and down and down. They've done some study that people that win some prize, I don't know what you call it here in India, but in America it's lottery. You have that here? Lottery. People that all of a sudden they win millions of dollars One of the most common things that happens is those people become drug addicts. And they don't know what to do with all their wealth. They're in the mode of ignorance, and all of a sudden they have a lot of wealth. So they do ignorant things with the wealth. So he was very unattached. He knew the foolishness of attachment by hearing. Actually, I'll narrate one other story. This isn't a Bhagavatam story, but it's the story of someone who can understand from hearing. So once upon a time, there was a man. And somehow, the man was on a ship, and the ship got shipwrecked. And he was the only surviving person left on the ship, struggling in the water, and somehow he washed up on the shore of an island. And when he reached the shore of the island, he was so relieved that he could just breathe without having to swim in the ocean. So he was very, very grateful. And he was found by the inhabitants of the island, and they were very happy to see him. In fact, they decided that they would make him the king of the island. And so they provided him with royal clothes and put him on the back of an elephant and a crown and all opulence, and they told him that you would be coronated for king for 365 days, one full year. And he was enjoying and enjoying, and some days passed, and then it occurred to him, what happens when the 365 days are over? So he asked the residents of the island, they said, oh, what we do is we'll take you off the elephant, beat you till you're almost dead, and then we'll send you cast away into another deserted island where there isn't anybody. And he thought, that's not a very good conclusion. So he said, what happened to the other people that did this? And he said, well, they just enjoyed like anything. Because they knew, well, at least for that much time, I'll be able to enjoy in royal style. And he said, I have to think this over. And so he decided, can you tell me where that island is that I would have to go to after 365 days are over? He said, yeah, we can show you where that place is. And then he said, well, then since I'm the king, I'd like to call for all the masons and carpenters and plumbers, and just bring them here. Well, I got a plan. So for the rest of the time that he was king, he had them build a nice house in that place where he was going to have to go after the 300. So he didn't finish the 365 days enjoying as the king. He was making sure that the house was built in a proper way and it would last for some time and with good materials. And sure enough, when the year was over, they beat him practically to death and sent him to the island, and there was this house where he could reside, and provisions were there, and everything was taken care of. Because he understood, this is all temporary. Whatever enjoyment I'm experiencing now, they've already told me, when 1 year is up, it's over. You're out of here. So the moral of the story is, our sojourn in this particular body, our experience of whatever happiness we're pursuing in this life, It's here today and gone tomorrow. So is it very wise to spend one's whole time taking shelter of this temporary arrangement? Is it an intelligent thing to do? Rather, one should be making the arrangements necessary for whatever that future destination is and preparing myself for that future destination. And in this particular story, preparing the future destination. Prabhupada gave a personal story about this when once he was visiting in Detroit, a city in America, famous for making cars, Detroit. And they didn't have a temple yet. They just had some apartment where the devotees lived, and for Prabhupada's visit, they rented a nice apartment for 1 week during his visit. So Prabhupada was explaining, what would you think if Swamiji came and spent the whole week while he was here in Detroit just making his apartment very comfortable, and then after the week he left? The whole time he just spent making the apartment very comfortable. What would you think of that? Something's wrong if that's what Swamiji is entirely doing. So, because this is only a temporary situation, one makes sure that necessities are there, that's okay. And beyond that, what is the higher purpose of this temporary place that we're in right now? How can we use our time and our intelligence and our human resources, our faculties, for achieving something more valuable than a temporary comfortable one, temporary comfortable situation, which isn't very comfortable after all anyway? So this is the third criterion of surrender. By intelligence, ideally first-class intelligence. The second and third-class intelligence is out of frustration or fear, passion and ignorance. Ideally out of goodness, just by hearing. These are impetuses for surrender. Now, what are some obstacles for surrender? Our acharyas discuss. There are the famous six enemies of the living entity. Kam, Krodh, Lobh, Moha, Mada, Matsarja. You've heard of these before? In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna identifies three of them as being gates to hell. Right? Bhagavad Gita, who knows the verse? Gates to hell, lust, anger, and greed. And many people are so busy with their affairs of greed, searching where is money, where is money, where is money. Because as everybody knows, money is the honey. It's the way that you can enjoy. And without money you can't be happy, right? So you got to have some money. And the more money you have, the more enjoyment you have, right? Wrong. I was giving a seminar in America in one graduate business school, business management or something like that. What do you call that here?
MBA.
Huh?
MBA.
MBA. The equivalent of MBA, but at a very prestigious university in America. And I started the seminar by asking them, you've been studying for so many years now, Since you're 5 years old, now you're in your 20s. So between 15 to 20 years of lots and lots and lots and lots of hours of study. And aside from in school, there's friends that you have and parents and wise people that you've associated with, and there's many lessons of life that you've learned. Can you describe or say in a very concise way, what is the objective of all of that knowledge? Guess what the answer was. Their minds were blank. Some person said success. So I asked, okay, success. What does success look like? What does it mean? The objective is success. And he thought and said, well, I know what it isn't. That's a good start. What isn't it? He said, it's not having a lot of things. Because I know people have a lot of things, and I know that they're very frustrated people. So success isn't just having a lot of things. That's second-class intelligent. He heard, didn't get it. He saw in others, and he got it. That's good, second-class intelligent. So I said it would probably be really helpful if you knew what success was. He said, yeah. So we went around the room some more, and I said, my premise is that success, in simple language, is feeling satisfied. Now, who in the material world is satisfied? If it's money, how much money makes you satisfied? Whatever money you have is always not enough. You have to have some more. Always have to have some more. That's the nature. Dushparena lalenacha. Like fire. Put some fuel in the fire, it just burns. More. It's never enough. So, impetuses for surrender come from those three sources and these three gates, lust, greed, and anger. They block, or worse, they take one away from surrender. So, to be successful at surrendering to Krishna, one has to abandon lust, anger, greed, moha, mada, matsarja, bewilderment or illusion, enviousness, one has to abandon these things. So it's easier to say you have to abandon those things than to abandon those things. So it's a simultaneous taking active shelter, and through that act of taking active business of taking shelter, having strength to abandon the obstacles or overcome the obstacles. So Jiva Goswami, in his Bhakti Sandarbha, he explains that there's a process that helps this taking shelter and abandoning false shelters. In its use of body, mind, and words properly. At least all of us have the power of speech. Some persons are unfortunate and they can't make sounds. But we can all speak. So if we use our speaking power to express our commitment to Krishna, to take shelter of Him, and our commitment to Krishna to abandon other shelters, then that's the process of speech used to assist in the surrendering process. And within the mind, to contemplate how to accomplish this. One devotee just wrote a question asking, when Prabhupada writes in a purport in chapter 1 of Bhagavad Gita that in Krishna consciousness we should practice devotional service by practical activity and by mental culture. Translate. The devotee asks, what does this mean, mental culture? Practice devotional service by mental culture. So just today I answered that question. And it means by contemplating how to fulfill the instruction of Krishna and the spiritual master in practical ways. In practical ways, for example, to consider how to provide Krishna conscious association for others, because that's one of Krishna's instructions. By being compassionate and teaching the message of Bhagavad Gita to others, there's no one more dear to Krishna than that person. Krishna likes that very much. Since we know that Krishna likes that very much, how can we do that practically? Or Krishna says, surrender unto me. So let me contemplate practically within the mind, how can I execute this instruction of Krishna? That's mental culture. And then the third is body, the practical activities. Again, I'll refer to Maharaj Ambarish as an example. With his words, he offered prayers to the Supreme Lord, glorifying Him and offering His humble service and submission. Within his mind, he also considered how to practically execute that. But with his body, he performed perfectly all the activities of worship and service to the Vaishnavas. He was fabulously wealthy, so he had a very wonderful temple room. Actually, he was a Krishna Bhakta. So he had a Krishna deity. And he had a temple room right in his palace. One can only imagine how opulent was his temple room. And he didn't hire somebody to keep it clean. He went in and cleaned every day. He was the king of the world. And he cleaned Krishna's temple with his own hand. And he didn't hire a pujari to worship the deity. With his own hand, he worshiped the deity. And in all ways, using his body, every day, this very elaborate list of descriptions, Savaimana Krishna Padara Vindayo Vachamsi Vaikuntha Gunana Varnane, and so on, the long description of how he served Krishna personally every day before he began his going to the office, sitting on the royal throne and ruling the world. So body, mind, and words. And this will come up again with the topic of maintenance, but we also use our bodies, aside from the activities of worship, we use our bodies for practical activity in day-to-day life, particularly in some work situation or some household responsibilities, some domestic duties. So we have to use our body along with our words and our mind in dedicated service in a mood of surrender to Krishna. So that combination, cultivating that, helps us in the surrendering process. So now what I'm going to do is ask you to refer to the song sheet, and we're going to cover out of the